From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
Here's the interesting thing about the Gotham Hotel, which, as you point out, was owned by African Americans. It was purchased in 1943, just several months after probably one of the worst race riots in America. Detroit endured a race riot in June of 1943, and in November of that year, about a half dozen African-American men, principally led by a gentleman named John White, purchased Gotham Hotel for $250,000 in 1943. that's another $1 million worth of nerve, $250,000 worth of nerve.
Right.
But the Gotham Hotel was described by many as a hotel as glamorous as anything in downtown on the Detroit skyline. The great poet Langston Hughes wrote about it in glowing terms through the Chicago Defender in the 1950s.
Ken Coleman, author of $1 Million Worth of Nerve, 21 People Who Helped Power Black Bottom, Paradise Valley, and Detroit's Lower East Side. Coleman is the popular author of On This Day in Detroit and Soul on Air. On This Day in Detroit shares facts about events in Detroit's African-American history on the same day that those events happened. In compiling the information for his first book, On This Day, African-American Life in Detroit, Coleman research kept pointing him towards Paradise Valley and Black Bottom of the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, then the political and cultural heart of Detroit's African-American community. Coleman decided to focus his next book on the rich life of these neighborhoods. $1 Million Worth of Nerve tells the story of Paradise Valley, Black Bottom, and the Lower East Side communities, how they came to be, the forces that caused their demise, systematic racism, discrimination, freeway construction, and suburban sprawl. The story is told in part through personality profiles of 21 Detroit residents, all of whom are African American. I'm Johnny O. Henson Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, $1 Million Worth of Nerve, Part 2 with Ken Coleman, In Black America.
Many people don't know this,
exactly.
But the first public housing project built in the United States was built in Detroit in 1935, in fact, 80 years ago. And it was such a momentous occasion that First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt was there for the groundbreaking. It was known as the Brewster Housing Project, and we would see in America dozens of projects like this built in urban cities throughout America, but the first one was built in Detroit, and it was a response to, quite frankly, FDR's New Deal. When he is elected, you know, in 1932, he takes a very different, as you know, takes a very different tone and approach to getting America back to work and providing resources for Americans, for the little guy, and that meant black people, too. And so the land, the community that I talked about earlier, Black Bottom, Paradise Valley, was an aging community by the 1930s, aging in terms of its physical structure. Lots of buildings didn't even have plumbing. It resembled the Mississippi Delta in a lot of ways.
Black Bottom was a predominantly African-American neighborhood in Detroit, Michigan, that was demolished and replaced with Lafayette Park in the 1960s. The Black Bottom and Paradise Valley area of the city's east side became known for a significant contribution to music, including blues, big band, and jazz, from the 1930s to the 1950s. The district reached its social, cultural, and political peak in the 1920s. African Americans owned 350 businesses in Detroit at the time, most of them Black Bottom. It was located on Detroit's Near East Side, bound by Gratiot Avenue, Brush Street, Vernon Highway, and the Grand Trunk Railroad tracks. The entire district was destroyed in the early 1960s. One had asked a question over the years, was it urban renewal or Negro removal? Born and raised in Detroit, Michigan, Ken Coleman attended Detroit Public Schools and later worked for DPS as a community relations officer. He has been active in Detroit media as a news anchor and an editor of the Michigan Chronicle and the Michigan Front Page. Also, he served as the City of Detroit Charter Revision Commissioner from 2009 to 2012. It took Coleman 16 months to research and write $1 Million Worth of Nerve. He says it was time well spent because the book presents a segment of the Motor City history you rarely read about. On today's program, we conclude our conversation with Ken Coleman.
Louis Martin is sent here in April of 1936. And he is quoted as saying, $135 in his pocket and $1 million worth of nerve. What I took Louis Martin to be saying is that to organize black people in Detroit in the 1930s and 40s took more, it was more than a notion, and it took people with extraordinary fortitude and strength. And that's, I think, what you see time after time in these stories that these 21 people carried out. They all have one thing in common. Some of them went to college, as you mentioned, John. Some of them didn't. Some of them were pastors, but some of them were what we call in today's terms, they were ballers.
Exactly.
I mean, they hung out. You know? But they all did something extraordinary. They all took on the status quo. Oftentimes they spoke truth to power, even when it hurt them personally or their family. But they all did it to improve their lives as individuals, but improve the lives of the community in which they lived. So one of the women that I write about in the book, Rosa Gregg, leads an organization called the National, or at that time, the Detroit Association of Colored Women's Organizations. They are a loosely formed umbrella group of dozens of black women's groups, their social groups. They were called, lots of these groups at the time were called study groups. And they would meet, and maybe sometimes around societal issues, economic advancement, or just playing bridge. But Rosa Gregg had an idea. She grew up in the lower, I mean, she not grew up, she lived on the Lower East Side of Detroit.
Right.
And there was a huge, huge home about 500 feet from her that she had designs on. She made up her mind. She wanted this home to be the headquarters for the organization, the Women's Clubs organization. The only problem is the home was located on Ferry Street in Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
And during that time, there were certain homes that had deed restrictions that would not allow an African American or perhaps someone Jewish to own the home,
right,
even if they had the money.
Exactly.
Well, Rosa Gregg was able to pull her resources, find out at some stage of the buying effort that they could not inhabitate the home because of a deed restriction. Well, $1 million worth of nerve. Rosa Gregg, she and her organization petitioned the city fathers and mothers, many at that time they're basically all white men, their fathers, petitioned city government downtown to change the address to Brush Street. And by doing that, was able to get around the deed restriction.
Exactly.
Well, that took tremendous gumption, tremendous nerve, $1 million worth of nerve. And so, again, these people, time after time, John, making a way out of no way, $1 million worth of nerve, challenging the status quo, challenging downtown, challenging racism, to move themselves ahead and African Americans ahead. That's the beauty, I think, in this and in the research that I've been able to do and been able to work on with others, is that there's so many of these stories. And at a time when many of us in Black America are facing challenges of some sort, it's empowering, inspiring, and motivating to look at these stories of these what these people did 30 and 40, 50, 60 years ago when, you know, they didn't have, you know, some of these organizations that we have now just weren't around at the time, or they were in their infancy stages and didn't wield the type of power. It's a fascinating was a fascinating time here, and other cities around America had similar stories, just like in Detroit.
Right. And a footnote to Rosa Lee, she earned a Doctor of Humanities degree from Paul Quinn College in Waco.
She did, absolutely. Imagine that, Waco, Texas. Imagine going down to get a PhD. What graduation day must have been, commencement day must have been like, a black woman who probably couldn't stop in a diner anywhere near Waco and have a cup of coffee. But that's who, and you know, Rosa Gregg actually graduated from, she earned her undergrad degree at Morse Brown College at age 16.
Exactly.
She was a PK, a, you know, a preacher's kid, very motivated and from day one. But she lived a very long life, and toward her later years was president of the National Association of Women's Clubs. They dropped the colored name from the title. And I write in the book, Rosa Gregg probably spent more nights, stayed overnight at the White House more than many foreign leaders. She was very, very close to the Roosevelts, particularly
right.
Eleanor.
Yeah, exactly.
She was an appointee of President Kennedy. She knew President Johnson. She actually moved, really, to Washington, D.C. In the late 50s and most of the 60s. But she's not only a great figure here in Detroit, but nationally as well.
One would not expect back in the day that Detroit had a grand hotel called the Gotham.
Absolutely. Yeah. And here's the interesting thing about the Gotham Hotel, which, as you point out, was owned by African Americans. It was purchased in 1943.
Right.
Just several months after probably one of the worst race riots in America.
Mm-hmm.
Detroit endured a race riot in June of 1943. And in November of that year, about a half dozen African-American men, principally led by a gentleman named John White,
mm-hmm.
purchased the Gotham Hotel for $250,000
in
1943. that's another $1 million worth of nerve, $250,000 worth of nerve.
Right.
But the Gotham Hotel was described by many as a hotel as glamorous as anything in downtown
mm-hmm.
on the Detroit skyline. The great poet Langston Hughes wrote about it in glowing terms through the Chicago Defender in the 1950s. But you know, in response to African Americans not being able to dine and stay overnight in downtown white-owned hotels, they pooled their resources together and bought their own hotel. And for about 20 years, the Gotham Hotel was the place where, when Duke Ellington came to play the Paradise Theater, he stayed there. When Count Basie came to play the El Cino Club, he stayed at the Gotham. It was known by many entertainers, and you could walk through the lobby of the hotel or have dinner at the fine dining mm-hmm. restaurant, the Ebony Room, named
right.
after the Ebony magazine, the Chicago-based magazine. You could walk through the Gotham Hotel any day of the week and see African Americans in their Sunday best. Fraternities and sororities had their meetings there. Retirement parties were held there. It was also sort of the political center of Black Detroit, and so you could walk in and see a handful of men huddled in a corner, you know, talking about how to fight police discrimination or how to run, you know, Charles Diggs for the U.S. House of Representatives, or how to, you know, how to fight racism in residential real estate in Detroit. It was a glowing set of times. The Gotham Hotel was operated again from 1943 to 1962.
Right.
And there's an interesting story about the hotel's demise as well.
Before we run out of time, Mr. Coleman, there's a couple of things I want to bring out. It's fascinating how these first movers and shakers shaped Detroit, but their offsprings took it to another level, particularly Reverend Nicholas Hood Sr. and
yes.
then his offspring, and then Charles Diggs and his offsprings.
Absolutely. I'll mention both of them. Reverend Hood, Reverend Nicholas Hood comes here by way, he was born in Indiana.
Right.
His first pastorship was in New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
He actually did a lot of work with Andy Young before coming here.
Exactly.
But Reverend Hood gets here in 1958. And at the time he gets here, Black Bottom and Paradise Valley are really in the early stages of their decline.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, urban renewal projects are taking over those communities. They're building a freeway right in the major on the major thoroughfare, Hastings Street.
Right.
And Reverend Hood says, we got a decision to make. He leads one of the most influential churches in the area, Plymouth Congregational. Reverend Hood says, we can do one or two things. We can complain about how our community is being bulldozed, or we can get on that train and make it work for us.
Mm-hmm.
And Nick Hood did that. In the 1960s and 70s, nobody was able to amass as much federal urban renewal housing dollars as Nicholas Hood and the nonprofit corporations that his church developed in the
right.
60s and 70s. And so as those communities were being bulldozed and as new construction was happening, Reverend Hood was one of those people that made sure that the people who lived there previously to the bulldozing
mm-hmm.
got a chance to live there and new affordable housing that was better than the housing in which they lived in before and gave them the dignity and respect that they deserved. And so Reverend Hood is a pivotal figure in Black Detroit's history because of that. I'll quickly go to the Diggs family. We mentioned earlier that Charles Diggs Sr. was a major business owner in Detroit. He owned a string of funeral homes, mm-hmm. but he was also part of a group that when there was even racism involved when you died,
right.
there were certain cemeteries that wouldn't place your plot, wouldn't, you know, you could not have burials
there.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. Charles Diggs Sr. and others, Haley Bell, Reverend Brabby, I mentioned earlier together, about 12 of them started their own cemetery, founded a Black-owned cemetery, speak to the racism that was existing. Well, Diggs was a powerful businessman in the 30s and 40s, and he was elected to the state Senate in Michigan. In mm-hmm. fact, he was the first Black Democrat to be elected to the state Senate. But he had a bigger vision for his son. And so he rose to the state Senate in our capital in Lansing, but he worked every day to make sure that his son, Charlie Diggs Jr., had an opportunity that was even greater than his. And so in 1954, he and many others led the way in making sure that Charlie Diggs was elected. And when Charlie Diggs gets elected to the U.S. House here from Detroit, the only other African Americans that are there are Adam Clayton Powell out of Harlem, and always escapes me the House member out of Chicago, Dawson. Charlie Diggs becomes the third African American in that era. Now, Reconstruction, you know, 70 or 80 years before, there were more African Americans in Congress. But at that time, only Dawson and Powell are there, and they greet Charlie Diggs Jr. As the third African American member of the U.S. House of Representatives.
A couple more questions, Mr. Cole.
Sure.
Tell us about Harold Bledsoe.
Yes, powerful man. Harold Bledsoe comes out of Marshall, Texas.
Exactly.
Small southern town, western town. Marshall, Texas. He's born in 1896.
Mm-hmm.
So he comes up at just in enough time to be one of the 350,000 African Americans who serve in some portion or some fashion in the First World War.
Right.
He comes to Detroit in 1925. It is a very interesting time because we have one of the touchstone moments in our city in 1925. A Black doctor named Ossian Sweet, medical doctor, moves into an all-white neighborhood in 1925 on the Lower East Side, and he is greeted with a group of very angry whites. And there is a confrontation. Ultimately, a white man is killed, and Dr. Sweet, his brother, and several members of his family, all Black, are held on murder charges of mm-hmm. this white man who invaded Dr. Sweet's home. Harold Bledsoe is part of the legal team in 1925, Black lawyers, imagine that, who are fighting to exonerate Dr. Sweet and his family. Now, Clarence Darrow certainly earned all of the billing for being the lead lawyer ultimately in this case. But if it wasn't for people like Harold Bledsoe, mm-hmm. The team of Black lawyers that were on the first case and there in the early days of the process, Dr. Sweet does not get a chance to have the criminal justice system work for him, and it's all because of Harold Bledsoe. One other very important point about Bledsoe. He, with several others, Charlie Diggs Sr., who I mentioned earlier,
mm-hmm.
create a movement in the early 1930s that moves African Americans away from the Republican Party
right.
and to the Democratic Party. Your listeners certainly know that the Republican Party was the party of Lincoln. Lincoln freed the slaves, mm-hmm. and so African Americans who could vote in those days, many of them voted for the Republican Party. But by the 1930s, people like Bledsoe have feel like the Republican Party has taken Black people for granted. And they organize an effort, quite frankly, a statewide effort, to move tens and thousands of African Americans to the Democratic Party. And a couple years later, Bledsoe becomes the first Black man to serve as an assistant state attorney general. Bledsoe was a very powerful figure in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, and he, like Hood and Diggs, always wanted more for his children than he was able to amass himself. He ran for circuit judge, at least on one occasion, was not successful. But many years later, in 1966, his daughter, Geraldine, was elected, and she became the first African-American woman to be elected to a judgeship in our state of Michigan. Again, $1 million worth of nerve, talking truth to power, organizing not only for one's own benefit, but the benefit of the entire community. Bledsoe is certainly one of those 21 people that I profile and who exhibited the $1 million worth of nerve spirit.
Mr. Coleman, last two questions. Tell us about the first public housing project built.
Many people don't know this,
exactly.
But the first public housing project built in the United States was built in Detroit in 1935, in fact, 80 years ago. And it was such a momentous occasion that First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt was there for the groundbreaking. It was known as the Brewster Housing Project, and we would see in America dozens of projects like this built in urban cities throughout America. But the first one was built in Detroit, and it was a response to, quite frankly, FDR's New Deal. When he is elected, in 1932, he takes a very different, takes a very different tone and approach to getting America back to work and providing resources for Americans for the little guy. And that meant black people, too. And so the land, the community that I talked about earlier, Black Bottom, Paradise Valley, was an aging community by the 1930s, aging in terms of its physical structure. Lots of buildings didn't even have plumbing. It resembled the Mississippi Delta in a lot of ways. And so the response from the federal government was to build federally funded public housing projects, and the Brewster becomes the first. In fact, interestingly enough, the last of the Brewster Douglas projects were demolished here in Detroit over the last 6 or 8 months, but it was part of our city's skyline, if you will,
exactly.
For several decades, and it was originally built, the first set of housing was built in 1935.
Well, you couldn't miss it if you took the John Lodge downtown.
That's right. That's right. In fact, the towers, much of the construction, as many of your listeners will certainly know, much of the public housing construction of the 40s and 50s resulted in 10 and 12 tower tenements.
Right.
And the Frederick Douglass portion of the Brewster Douglass complex was 6 14-story buildings, which, could certainly be seen from downtown and several miles north. And as you point out, any trip along any of the major arteries going into downtown, you could not miss those structures. But as we moved into the 80s and 90s, John, those buildings and structures were in the same disrepair and aging state
right.
as the buildings that they replaced 80 years before. And so now there's a great discussion. And that's why I really wrote the book. We're having a discussion about gentrification now, and what's happening to some of these black communities. And there's a lot of concern about that particular community and who the new housing will be built for, as opposed to a conversation about building housing for people who live there.
I know we could talk for days, but I just want to bring one thing out before I let you go. Considering all the major events that happened downtown, it happens in Cobo Hall, but I could not believe how mean-spirited Mr. Mayor Albert E. Cobo was.
Yeah, it is amazing. We just had this conversation about building public housing.
Mm-hmm.
Albert E. Cobo gets elected. He's a Republican. He gets elected in 1949. And what's going on in the country is a lot of fatigue, if you will, around 4 or 5 elections, the FDR elections and the Truman presidency. America's coming off the Second World War. The Cold War started. The Korean conflict is getting ready to happen. And so people like Cobo were elected throughout the country.
Mm-hmm.
Cobo's a right winger. I mean, he'd be some of these 12 or 13 Republican presidential candidates that we're seeing pop up. He's out of that same mode. And so Cobo immediately really seeks to undo in quick order all the progress that had been made for African Americans by white leadership and right. black leadership together. He throws people like Robert Bradbee Jr. off the Housing Commission. There are as many as a dozen public housing projects planned for Detroit in 1949, but when he gets elected, he nixes all of them. And so he literally bulldozes the Black Bottom community and almost leaves it for dead, to so much so that there was, after he had bulldozed the community, there was 5 years before new housing was built in the land where Black Bottom sat. And when it was built, it was built for a middle-class community, and that community became known as Lafayette Park. Cobo has a convention center, as you mentioned, named after him, but Arthur Johnson, who was one of the most revered civil rights leaders in our community, he was a leader of the local NAACP. He worked for the Detroit Public School District and our major university, Wayne State University, probably one of the most soft-spoken, caring men with regard to race in this region. Arthur Johnson called Albert Cobo a racist. And so for many people that know of Arthur Johnson, for him to say that, Mayor Cobo must have been one of the worst things that ever happened to Black America. And I chronicle a lot of his unfortunate deeds in my book, Million Dollars Worth of Nerve.
Mr. Coleman, what do you want readers to come away with?
Well, I want them to come away with, this is not only a great set of stories for history's sake, but we in Detroit, and we've seen it in recent years in Harlem and in Washington, D.C., we've seen the effects of gentrification, how communities are changing and the complexion of them are changing, and they aren't being rebuilt for people who lived there before. I hope that Million Dollars Worth of Nerve triggers even more discussion about making sure that America's promise is for everybody, whether you happen to be African-American or white or from any other ethnic group or racial affiliation. It's an important discussion to have. Detroit is changing again, and there's a conversation now about whether or not Black Detroiters are welcome downtown. And so the book comes at an interesting time. We often say nothing is new under the sun. And if we aren't careful, John, we'll make some of the same mistakes that we've made in previous generations, and we'll all suffer because of it.
Ken Coleman, author of Million Dollars Worth of Nerve, 21 People Who Helped Power Black Bottom, Paradise Valley, and Detroit's Lower East Side. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at jhanson@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Remember to like us on Facebook and to follow us on Twitter. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny O'Hanson Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.